and welcome to another Ask Me Anything Life Support in Intensive Care ICU Decisions, Tracheostomy Decisions and Intensive Care at Home. That's what we're going to talk about today, and you can ask me anything. So thank you for joining this call, and also thank you for any viewers that watch this on replay, because I know there's always quite a lot of viewers watching this on replay. So thank you for your engagement there as well. Now, before we go into today's questions and comments, what makes me qualified to host a show like this, where I answer pretty much anything for families, in any questions that families in intensive care have or anybody has about intensive care at home. So my name is Patrick Hutzel. I am a critical care nurse by background, having worked in critical care nursing for over 25 years in three different countries, where I worked as a nurse manager for over 5 years. And I've been consulting and advocating for families in intensive care here at intensivecarehotline.com since 2013. And I can very, very confidently say that we have saved many lives for our clients and their families in intensive care. And that is actually documented on our testimonial section at intensivecarehotline.com. And it is also documented on our intensivecarehotline.com podcast section, where we have done client interviews. Now, I'm also the founder and managing director of Intensive Care at Home, and you can find more information at intensivecareathome.com. With Intensive Care at Home, we are sending our critical care nurses into the home 24 hours a day for long-term intensive care patients, predominantly for long-term ventilated and tracheostomy intensive care patients, but also for adults and children that are not ventilated but have a tracheostomy, need still 24-hour critical care nurses. Also for clients that have adults and children that are BiPAP or CPAP dependent without a tracheostomy, that are cofferassist machine dependent, that are needing home TPN, home IV potassium, home IV magnesium infusions, home IV antibiotics, PEEK line, central line, Hickman's, as well as port management at home. That's all part of it. Nasogastric tube, nasotracheostomy tube, PEG, patch management at home, palliative care services at home, ventilator weaning at home. That is all part of it. Now, with intensive care at home, we are currently operating all around Australia in all major capital cities, as well as in all regional and rural areas. And like I said, we are sending our critical care nurses into the home 24 hours a day, and we're providing a genuine alternative to a long-term stay in intensive care. And we're providing services to NDIS, TAC, DVA, and so forth. Now, also, if you like my videos here, click the like button, click the notification bell, subscribe to my YouTube channel for regular updates for families in intensive care, and share the video with anyone that will benefit from these videos, especially if they have a family member, a loved one in intensive care. So, without further ado, let's go into today's topics. And also, I usually go for about an hour. Depends a little bit sometimes, but I usually have about an hour here. Also, if you do have any questions, please type them into the chat pad or connect with me live here on the StreamYard link. So I actually want to start with another testimonial this week. I have made some blogs about this client on and off in the last few weeks. In a nutshell, we had a client for Intensive Care Hotline, would have been in July, I believe. A 51-year-old man is going into ICU with a hemorrhagic stroke, and things weren't looking great. And ICU, the ICU was very adamant from day one to simply withdraw treatment, saying things to the family such as, well, your family member won't have any quality of life if they do survive, but it is actually very unlikely that they will survive. And if, as a matter of fact, they were sort of becoming very pushy and saying things like, you know, if it was my family member, we wouldn't want them to live. And, you know, this family said, well, doesn't matter what you think, we want our family member to live. And eventually, as the pressure was mounting from the ICU to this family, they were reaching out to us here at intensivecarehotline.com and were looking for advice. And like in many other similar situations, we were, of course, able to turn this around. And in a nutshell, this man is still alive to this day, even though ICU was predicting, well, he won't survive. And if he will survive, he won't have any quality of life. And they were, like I said, pushy to take the breathing tube out on certain days. Say, oh, this today's the day, we just take out the breathing tube and we'll take a sink or swim approach. And it became abundantly clear that it would have been the sink approach and the client would have died. Now, that sounds very cruel, but, you know, for those of you watching it, you also know that this is an unfortunate reality in some ICUs, you know. And they're not necessarily here to do the what's best for your family member. So I was then rocking up for some family meetings in person with this family. And, you know, I was putting back the pressure on the ICU saying, well, 70 to 90% of ICU patients survive. So why would this man not survive? You know, but this is actually, I want to hone in on that one. If you're watching this, you know, no matter what ICU is telling you, the odds are in your loved one's favor in ICU to survive. So you really need to ask, why is ICU telling you such a doom and gloom story if the odds are in your loved one's favor? Shouldn't the ICU be moving heaven and earth to improve your loved one's life and make sure they are surviving, make sure the odds are staying in your loved one's favor, right? So then the next thing that I did there is educating the family on a tracheostomy as an option. So this particular family had no idea that a tracheostomy would be an option to prolong this gentleman's life, to buy him time to hopefully wake up, improve, you know, and recover. So the ICU was conveniently sweeping under the carpet that a tracheostomy might be an option, right? And once I explained to them that a tracheostomy should be an option, and they were presenting that to the ICU team, they were saying initially, oh, he wouldn't be a candidate for a tracheostomy. What a whole lot of rubbish. But, you know, in the end, of course, we succeeded in advocating successfully for a tracheostomy, and the client then ended up with a tracheostomy instead of an end-of-life situation that the family simply didn't want. The first thing that you need to ask yourself is when you have a family member in a sort of similar situation, the first thing that you need to ask yourself when ICU is becoming pushy and wanting to withdraw treatment, the first thing that you need to ask yourself is, where's the rush? Where's the urgency to kill your family member? Why is there no urgency and bias to help them survive and improve? If you don't ask those very questions, you've already lost. You know, again, where's the rush? Where's the urgency to kill someone? Well, I can tell you the answer to that. The rush and urgency is always that ICUs are under a lot of pressure from a bed management point of view. They need the beds, they need the staff, they need equipment, they need the resources, because they've got plenty of other patients knocking on their doors, right? That is one of the main reasons. I've worked in ICU for 20 years in three different countries, and it's the same everywhere, right? So you've got to read between the lines, folks. You've got to read between the lines. You have to look at it for what it is. It's not wishful thinking. It just is. You know? If you find yourself in an impossible situation, you don't need the muscles of Hercules. You don't need the mind of an Einstein. You don't need the reflexes of a Grand Prix driver. You simply need to know what to do. You simply need to know what to do, right? Because those situations present themselves out of nowhere. You weren't researching last week, oh, what if my family member goes into ICU next week? You're not doing that, understandably. But now that you're here, and now that you're watching this, now you understand this can hit anyone out of nowhere. And then it's simply a case of knowing what to do and how to turn the seemingly impossible around. And I encourage you to have a look on our testimonial website at intensivegeholdland.com, of our testimonial section, what our clients say. And I encourage you to watch some of our client interviews at intensivegeholdland.com on our podcast section. So you can actually verify that, you know, we have saved so many lives with our intensive care insights, with our consulting advocacy, just understanding intensive care inside out, just understanding how ICUs operate, just understanding about patient and family rights, because ICU would want to make you believe you have no rights. Right? Don't believe that for 1 minute. You have rights. You just need to exercise them. So, so with this family, obviously, like I said, I was in family meetings myself at the time in person and, you know, putting the pressure back on the ICU. And I also want to read out a letter from this family to the hospital at the time, because I believe that's how most of you feel. You know, I think this letter really illustrates, or email that we asked the family to send to the hospital administrator, as hospital executive, really sums up how most families in intensive care feel all around the world. So let me read out this letter. Dear hospital executive, my name is such and such, and I write this letter on behalf of my sister-in-law, such and such, and our family regarding the treatment and communication we have received in relation to my brother, who is currently in the intensive care unit at X Hospital. We are deeply concerned about the overall approach and lack of empathy shown by some of the ICU staff and doctors. Within just the second or third day of my brother's admission, discussions were already being held about the possibility of ending his life. Again, where's the urgency to kill someone? The email continues. These conversations were presented with an overwhelming focus on the negative, painting a picture of paralysis, no speech, no mobility, without even an ounce of hope or balance. We were confronted with a question: do you think your brother would want to live like this? This line of questioning was distressing and frankly, premature, especially considering the emotional state of our family at that time. This experience left us feeling uncertain, insecure, and unsupported. As a result, I felt compelled to engage a private ICU nursing consultant to help interpret the medical situation and provide clear, independent advice, something we believed should have been delivered with more transparency and structure by the hospital team. When she's referring to the independent nursing ICU consultant, that's obviously myself and my team that she engaged, her and her family engaged, I should say. To this date, medical updates have only been provided during ad hoc meetings without any agenda or adequate preparation, which places significant strain on our family. This lack of structure and consistency has made it very difficult for us to stay fully informed and involved in Peter's, in the client's care, in our brother's care. As a result, I will be seeking direct access to my brother's medical information through the appropriate channels, including a freedom of information request to ensure we have a comprehensive understanding of his condition and care. We understand and accept the severity of my brother's brain injury, and we do not take lightly the reality of what his future life might entail. However, the decision regarding my brother's care, especially around life-sustaining measures, is one that rests with his wife and immediate family. We ask that this be respected at all times, and that my brother's time in the ICU be guided by a commitment to preserving life and ensuring his comfort rather than overshadowed by defeat and negativity. Let me just repeat that, because I know that's how a lot of you feel. We ask that this be respected and that my brother's time in the ICU be guided by a commitment to preserving life and ensuring his comfort rather than overshadowed by defeat and negativity. Because that's, you know, when families call us here at intensivecarehotline.com, you know, that's what they're reporting to us. Overwhelming negativity, doom and gloom. Their loved ones are going to die. And even if they were survived, they have no quality of life and all this doom and gloom nonsense. But, you know, I'll come to the happy ending of this story. So the email continues. Furthermore, I wish to raise a formal request regarding the use of light therapy in my brother's room. I have conducted thorough research and provided evidence, including websites and studies, which outlines the benefits of red light therapy in supporting neurological recovery, calming inflammation, and improving overall well-being. It is a non-invasive therapy and could offer some comfort and healing, however minimal. We have been advised that this may not be permitted in Peter's room, but no clear reason has been provided. We respectfully ask that this decision be reconsidered with an open mind, particularly as we explore every possible avenue, both medical and holistic, to support my brother's healing journey. We know that to many, Peter may be one of many patients, but to us, he's a father, son, brother, and husband. We've been told bluntly that he will likely die in ICU and never return home. While we understand the reality of the situation, we're also seeking compassion, understanding, and a glimmer of hope, something that we feel has been missing from the hospital's approach. We are not asking for miracles. We are asking for empathy, for space to hope, and for the hospital to walk this difficult path with us, not ahead of us. We look forward to your response. Kind regards. So, this letter or this email, on top of, you know, pressure from the family and me and my team to keep this man alive, to give him the choice of a tracheostomy, to buy him time, led to him surviving. And that's why I'm saying with much confidence here that we have saved and continue to save many lives for our clients in intensive care, because, you know, that often buys patients and families time. You know, keep in mind, if your loved one's situation is not improving, there's plenty of time to talk about end of life, plenty of time. Now, once you have stopped treatment, there's no time to talk about end of life, right? Now, fast forward, I have been staying in touch, obviously, with the family, right? And they have been saying that he has been improving, right? That a few weeks ago, he was starting to mouth words, even with a tracheostomy. You know, that is someone who was meant to die. So then also on that note, given that ICU told them, oh, he's going to die, also on that note, you have to question the ICU team's clinical judgment. Or, you know, are they staying in control of the narrative because they want to be in control of the ICU beds? And I can tell you that's what they do. Right? And a couple of weeks ago, when I spoke to the patient's brother, he said that he's been mobilized daily. He pulled out his nasogastric tube. That's a good sign. Right? He had some ice cream. He has his eyes open every day. He needs some regular tracheostomy suction. And, you know, that was progress in and of itself. Now, spoke to the brother again a couple of days ago, and here's his text to me. When I asked him how is his brother doing, he says, my brother's doing great. He has been moved to the stroke ward. They removed the tracheostomy a few days ago, and within a week or two should start his rehabilitation. Now I can tell you what my response to that text was. I said, he's coming back from the proposed deathbed from the almighty ICU doctors. Now, with all respect, I've worked with plenty of ICU doctors over the years, no ill will to any of them. But the bottom line is how this ICU presented themselves to the family was, well, they know it all, they've seen it all, and they know exactly the outcome, and the outcome was death. Well, without the advocacy that was needed, this client would be dead by now. They would have extubated him, and he would have died a horrible death with an aspiration pneumonia because at that stage, he wasn't able to protect his airway. Now, to top this all off, the client sent me pictures from his brother or of his brother. And they've got a picture, two pictures there where the whole family is in the picture. And he's in a wheelchair, but he's got his eyes open, you know, and clearly he's aware of his surroundings. Now, compare that to letting someone die after 2 or 3 days. Right? So never, ever give up. Never, ever give up. Right? So it's another testimony that, you know, you can never give up. You know, you always need to fight the good fight. And, you know, tracheostomy is out from someone that was dying a few weeks ago. And you have to question everything. What you see in ICU is not what you get. If you can't read between the lines, if you don't know what to look for, if you don't know what questions to ask, your loved one may die because the ICU team is telling you so, and they've got the means, you know, to stop life support prematurely instead of continuing life support, making sure your loved one can function without life support. You know, there's plenty of things that can be done in ICU. And keep in mind, it's the minority, not the majority of patients that's dying in ICU, right? So this is another success story, you know, to show our viewers what is possible. Now, it is early days and this family is still in the midst of, you know, making sure their loved one keeps improving. But I hope that one day I can get them on a podcast here as well. So, then let's look at other testimonials that have come in. I might have read them out before, but I think it's always important that we keep track of the advocacy, that we keep track of the testimonials. Here was another one, a brief one, from one of our members, actually, who says, I want to thank Patrick Hutzel and his intensivecarehotline.com team for their support and advocacy in my dad's life. Being able to communicate with your team when I needed clarity while things were unfolding, the team didn't leave me unanswered, even though it was through email. You were right there. Thank you very much for comforting me because I was extremely vulnerable and you truly had my back. Again, I want to thank each and every one of you for being the voice when we needed you all the most. I thank you for being here in these difficult times in our life. We love you, Patrick, and your intensivecarehotline.com team. And thank you for this testimony from one of our members. We really appreciate it because, you know, we're here when you need us. I also have another testimony that came in this week where another client says, hi, Patrick, my mom passed away peacefully at age 93. Her heart just stopped. We miss her dearly, but I wanted to let you know how much we appreciated your guidance throughout the process. I have no doubt that the advice from you contributed to the outstanding quality of care she received at all hospitals, which definitely prolonged her life. Tracheostomy you advised bought us additional time, as I had done everything possible I could have done for her, and God did the rest. Thank you so much for everything. Now, when I say we saved many lives, that is absolutely accurate. But sometimes it's also a case of simply buying time, and making sure your loved one can have an end-of-life situation on their terms, on your terms, not on the ICU's terms or ICU timelines, which is often to free up the beds. Don't do that. The biggest challenge for families in intensive care is simply that they don't know what they don't know. They don't know what to look for. They don't know what questions to ask. They don't know their rights, and they don't know how to manage doctors and nurses in intensive care. That's exactly what 99.9% of families in intensive care are up against. They don't know what they don't know. It's very simple, right? And I know I can help you, me and my team can help you to turn your situation around as well. No matter how difficult it is now, as long as you can follow instructions, as long as you can think clearly, right? And you can follow instructions, and they're often simple instructions. Do this, do that, do this, do that. Right? It's often no more complicated than that. Okay? And that will help you to get better care treatment and best care and treatment for your family member. Now, let's just take this client that I just spoke about, where I said the ICU didn't tell them about a tracheostomy as an option. Now, I can tell you there's almost every ICU patient where the ICU is not transparent about all treatment options. Right? And again, that's where me and my team can help you fast. Very fast, as a matter of fact. Right? So keep that in mind at all times. So, what questions do you have? What questions do you have when you have a family member in intensive care? Let me know in the comment section, or connect with me live here on the StreamYard link. Other questions that we've answered throughout the week, and one question that is coming up quite frequently is, can a tracheostomy be reversed? What families in intensive care must know? So let's look at this. So one of the most frequent questions I get from families in intensive care is, can a tracheostomy be reversed? The short and simple answer is yes, a tracheostomy can often be reversed. But whether it can be removed or not depends on your loved one's overall condition, their ability to breathe independently, and their ability to protect the airway. Let's break this down. Why is a tracheostomy needed in the first place? A tracheostomy is usually performed when a patient needs prolonged ventilator support beyond 7 to 14 days of intubation. If there are difficulties weaning off the breathing tube, the airway needs protection because the patient can't swallow safely. Long-term access for airway management is required. So when can a tracheostomy be reversed, which is also known as decannulation? So the reversal is called decannulation, removing the tracheostomy tube once it's no longer required. This is possible when, number one, your loved one is off the ventilator or very close to coming off. Number two, they can clear secretions and cough effectively. Number three, they can swallow safely without aspiration. Number four, they're medically stable to maintain their own airway. And how does the process work? Decannulation is rarely immediate. It usually involves weaning trials off the ventilator, using a speaking valve or capping the tracheostomy to test tolerance, close monitoring by ICU or step-down unit teams. If your loved one passes all of these trials, the tracheostomy can often be reversed successfully. So let's look at when a tracheostomy cannot be reversed. In some cases, the tracheostomy may be permanent. For example, if your loved one has severe neurological injuries, spinal cord injuries, progressive neuromuscular disease, ongoing need for long-term ventilation or ongoing need for a long-term tracheostomy. When the ability to swallow is no longer there or temporarily not there. But here's the good news. Even if the tracheostomy cannot be reversed, your loved one doesn't need to stay in ICU long-term. This is where intensive care at home comes in. At intensive care at home, we provide specialist services that allows long-term ventilated and tracheostomized patients, adults and children, to go home with 24/7 intensive care nurses. It's a far better alternative than being stuck in an ICU or somewhere long-term in a hospital rehabilitation, whatever the case may be. Families get quality of life and patients get the dignity and comfort of being cared for at home with intensive care at home. And I encourage you to check out intensivecareathome.com for more information there. So what's the bottom line here? The bottom line is that a tracheostomy can often be reversed, but it depends on the individual situation. And even if it can't, there are still options beyond intensive care. Don't let the ICU teams push you into decisions without exploring all possibilities. Let's look at the conclusion and the call to action. If your loved one is in intensive care with a tracheostomy and you're unsure whether it can be reversed or if the ICU is telling you it can't, reach out to us at intensivecarehotline.com and we can help you guide from there. Right? So, also, I have brought this up here before many times, but I think it is so important that you understand the difference. You know, let's just go back to the beginning where I talked about, you know, clients where we have saved their lives and with our consulting and advocacy. Now, one of the main questions when you have a loved one critically ill in intensive care and ICU wants to push towards end of life is your loved one in a real or in a perceived end of life situation? Real versus perceived end of life situation. What's the difference? I'm glad you asked. A real end of life situation is when nothing, and I mean nothing, no medication, no surgery, no fancy equipment, no nothing will save your loved one's life. They're going to die there at the end of their life, and that's the bottom line. That's a real end of life situation. A perceived end of life situation, on the other hand, is what most critically ill patients in intensive care are actually in. It's a perception. And it's a perception that's often being pushed by intensive care teams without any real evidence, right? So let's take our client from earlier where we saved their life with our advocacy. That was a perceived end-of-life situation. The perception from the intensive care team was they're not going to survive, full stop. Without offering all treatment options, i.e. a tracheostomy was one of those treatment options. Right? You have to think about that. Is it real or perceived? And I can assure you that the overwhelming majority of situations in intensive care are perceived end-of-life situations. They're not real end-of-life situations. Let no one fool you here. Right? You need to be armed with asking the right questions here when you have a loved one in intensive care. If you don't know what questions to ask, you will be fighting an uphill battle. That is the bottom line. Right? ICU teams might walk all over you. I've seen it, unfortunately. Right? So, think about that. What's the agenda in ICU? Is it always to help your loved one? No, the agenda is to save money, to free up ICU bed space for the next patient, That, unfortunately, is often the agenda. You know? And I wish it was different. I wish it was different, but it's not. You know? And you just got to look at reality for what it is, not for what you want it to be. You know? So I have another question here from Cornelius, who says, my family member in intensive care is not being properly weaned from the ventilator. Now, whilst this is a very vague question, I think it's also a very important question, and there's two sides to that. So the first side of it is, when someone is not being properly weaned from the ventilator, is are they on the ventilator with a breathing tube? Or are they on the ventilator with a tracheostomy? Or are they on a ventilator just with a mask, which is BiPAP or CPAP ventilation? Now, most of the time in ICU, it's breathing tube or tracheostomy, but there are also plenty of patients in ICU that need to be weaned off BiPAP and CPAP, right? Now, the aim of BiPAP and CPAP in ICU is often just simply to expand the lungs, making sure there's enough oxygen going in and carbon dioxide is being removed. And that often can be weaned gradually, just by reducing the BiPAP, by reducing the pressure, by reducing the PEEP, by reducing oxygen support. Patients, generally speaking, are not sedated, right? So they should be awake. As a matter of fact, they are awake most of the time, because you can't really give BiPAP on a non-awake patient, because otherwise they can't protect their airway and they are at high risk of aspiration. So that's number one, BiPAP or CPAP. So that's how, you know, one should wean there. Also through mobilization, chest physio, you know, good nursing care, of course. That's how BiPAP or CPAP without tracheostomy can be weaned. Now, let's look at a breathing tube with a ventilator. How should that be weaned? Well, I made a video a couple of years ago, how to wean a critically ill patient off the ventilator and the breathing tube. And I encourage you to check out this video and blog post, because it gives you a step-by-step guide how your loved one should be weaned off the ventilator and the breathing tube. Now, miss one of those steps and things can go pear-shaped. Now, the other question that you should always ask yourself when your loved one is on a ventilator with a breathing tube, is the ICU doing everything beyond the shadow of a doubt to wean your loved one off the ventilator and the breathing tube? Right? Let me repeat that. Is the ICU doing everything beyond the shadow of a doubt to wean your loved one off the ventilator and the breathing tube? Because if they're not, the consequences might be a tracheostomy, and you're trying to avoid that. Now, you know, you might be wondering, if you watch this from the beginning, you know, you talked about advocating for a client for a tracheostomy, and now you're advocating against it. Well, let me be clear. You know, a lot of situations in ICU are not black and white, and a lot of situations are that the devil is in the details. So why would we advocate for one client to have a tracheostomy? Why would we advocate against it for another client? Well, again, this is where clinical insights and experience come in, and knowledge and just skills, right? So for the client that we talked about earlier with the stroke, where ICU said, oh, we'll just take the breathing tube out and we let him die. Well, that's not a good scenario, because ICUs need to prolong life, not shorten life, unless it's a patient's wish or a family's wish. So by not doing a tracheostomy, this patient would have died, most likely, right? So in that case, a tracheostomy was the right thing to do. In this case here, with the breathing tube, well, you need to avoid the tracheostomy. You need to make sure this person will get off the ventilator. Right? That's the bottom line. Right? So, the question here is, for a patient on a ventilator with a breathing tube, what are you doing to avoid the tracheostomy? What are you doing to get my loved one off the ventilator and the breathing tube? Show me beyond the shadow of a doubt. Right? There's weaning protocols, you know, experienced people like myself can talk you through it step by step. What they need to do. And I can see very quickly whether they're doing the right things or not. And I can easily hold them accountable. And you will see by doing so that the dynamics will shift in your favor in no time. Next, let's look at when a patient is on a tracheostomy and can't be weaned off the ventilator, or, you know, as this reader is referring to, not being properly weaned from the ventilator. So let's just say your loved one is having a tracheostomy, is ventilator dependent, and they can't be weaned. What are the missing links? Now let's assume your loved one is not, you know, having a high spinal injury like C1, C2 spinal injury, is not having motor neuron disease, is not having any other neuromuscular degenerative disease that stops them from being weaned off the ventilator, right? Then the following needs to happen to wean your loved one off the ventilator and the breathing tube and the tracheostomy. Number one, stop all sedatives and stop all opiates. Now, one of the main reasons a patient should have a tracheostomy is simply because of minimization of sedation and opiates, right? So, as I explained earlier, most patients on a breathing tube need sedatives and opiates in order to tolerate the breathing tube. So one of the main purposes for doing a tracheostomy is to minimize all of that. Minimize opiates, minimize sedatives, right? So that's number one. Make sure that your family member is off all opiates and all sedatives. Because a tracheostomy is much easier to tolerate than a breathing tube. That's number one. Number two, make sure they are being mobilized every day. So, you know, families have this preconceived notion that just because someone is in intensive care, they can't be mobilized, they can't be getting out of bed. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. They can be mobilized and they can get out of bed. So, when your loved one is being ventilated with a tracheostomy, they need to be off all sedation, off all sedatives. They need to be mobilized every single day, right? And that is what will help them to get off the ventilator. And that's, you know, sort of a step-by-step gradual process. Sometimes it's a case of sitting on the edge of the bed for 2 minutes. Next day, sitting on the edge of the bed for 10 minutes. Depending on how, you know, easy they can tolerate that. Then sitting in a chair for 20 minutes, build it up to 30 minutes, build it up to an hour, build it up to 2 hours, build it up to 2 hours in the morning, have a break in the afternoon, build it up to 2 hours in the afternoon, build it up to a day, you know, for the whole day so they can sleep at night. There's a gradual process that needs to happen, right? So very important that you know what to do. You know what to look for. Don't let ICUs tell you they can't mobilize your family member. No, don't let them tell you that, because they can. Right? Don't let ICUs tell you they can't wean your loved one off the ventilator. Right? They can. They have the skill. Now, there are situations where, you know, your loved one might be so deconditioned, they might be so weak that it takes time, or it might not be possible. There are those situations. But if that's the case, then, you know, you have the option of intensive care at home, right? So go and check out intensivecareathome.com, because with intensive care at home, we're actually looking after long-term ventilated adults and children with tracheostomies at home as a genuine alternative to a long-term stay in intensive care, right? And that's when you can get help at home. Now, who's going to pay for it? I know you'll ask that question. So it depends where you are, right? But you got to look at basic economics here. Now, basic economics are that an intensive care bed costs between $5,000 to $6,000 per bed day. Doesn't matter whether you're in the US, Australia, UK would be obviously in British pounds. You know, with intensive care at home, it's half of that cost. No brainer. Because where do you want to be? Do you want to be at home or do you want to be in the hospital? Now, I've talked about ICUs needing beds today at length. So what does ICU want? ICU wants an empty bed. It's a win-win situation. It is a win-win situation. Very simple. Right. Everyone's winning by doing so. But to come back to how is your loved one being weaned off the ventilator properly, it's also a case of reducing ventilation settings, right? And I can guide you by, you know, if I know the ventilator settings, I can guide you what they should be doing with that. Been there, done that in 25 years of ICU nursing, right? So I can walk you through it step by step, what they should be doing. And if they're doing it, right? Because you don't know what you don't know. So just know that most patients in intensive care will be able to survive. Right? So, next question. This is actually an interesting comment from a critical care RN on one of my YouTube videos, and thank you for Katie for making that comment. Critical care RN here working in LTAC. Either you wean or you die. A nosocomial infection is next. LTAC is depressing, but so is keeping patients alive with no quality. Now, thank you for that comment. I'm curious to hear that a CCRN is actually working at an LTAC. That's very unusual. Either you wean or you die. Yeah, but the problem here is that most LTACs are not even trying to wean. Right? And that makes it even more likely that a nosocomial infection might be next. What's a nosocomial infection? It's basically a hospital-acquired infection. LTAC is depressing, but so is keeping patients alive with no quality of life. I disagree there. Well, I agree with that LTACs are depressing. I agree with that. But so is keeping patients alive with no quality of life. Well, quality of life is only really possible at home. That's the bottom line. It's only really possible at home. Right? That is the bottom line. And that's where intensive care at home comes in. Well, thank you for sharing that comment because, again, it's RNs confirming CCRNs that LTACs are depressing. You know. So I am going to wrap this up in a minute. So with, you know, intensive care hotline, like I've said, we have saved so many lives for our clients in intensive care over the years. And you can verify that on our intensivecarehotline.com podcast section or at our with client interviews or on our testimonial section. Right? We have a membership for families of critically ill patients in intensive care. You can become a member there. You can also book a free 15-minute consulting call with myself by either calling me on one of the numbers on the top of our website at intensivecarehotline.com. Or by simply scheduling a 15-minute free call with me. If you go to intensivecarehotline.com and you click on the schedule appointment tab. And I can get on a phone or on a Zoom call with you, whichever, or on a WhatsApp call, whichever medium you prefer. Right? I also do one-on-one consulting and advocacy over the phone, Zoom, WhatsApp, whichever medium works best for you, you know. If you want someone to help you turn this seemingly impossible situation around when you have a family member in intensive care critically ill, you are at the right place here. with intensive care at home, go and check out intensivecareathome.com. Once again, we are saving many lives. We have saved many lives with intensivecareathome.com. And instead of keeping patients in ICU long term. And again, you can verify that by looking at our case studies, at our looking at our testimonial section. You know, also, if you are a critical care nurse and you're looking for a career change, we are currently looking for critical care nurses in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, in Albury, Wodonga, in Geelong, in Warragul, in Victoria, in Bendigo, also in the Colac, Wielangta area in Victoria. We are also currently expanding our medical team, and we are looking for intensive care consultants that want to work with us, including where right now we have a vacancy in Brisbane for an intensive care consultant to work with one of our home care clients one-on-one. So we would really want to hear from you if you're an intensive care specialist in the Brisbane area in Australia. Now, lastly, I want to thank you for watching this. Share the video with your friends and families. Like the video. Subscribe to my YouTube channel for regular updates for families in intensive care and intensive care at home. And comment, leave your comments so I know what content you want me to create. And I will talk to you during the week with my quick tip videos, and I will talk to you again in another live stream next week. Same time, 10:30 a.m. Sunday, Sydney, Melbourne time, which is at the moment 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on a Saturday night in the U.S. on the East Coast, and it's 5:30 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon Pacific time in the US. This is Patrick Hutzel from intensivecarehotline.com and intensivecareathome.com. Thank you, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.